am
the heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
And this is your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW Washington. Up next, David Whetstone normally comes your way with We the People, and he is out today, so we will be playing a discussion from the Electronic Intifada on why Israel is arming ISIS in Gaza. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Ali Abonema, here with my colleague Asa Winstanley. On the Electronic Intifada live stream on June 5th, we discussed the revelation that Israel has been arming a criminal gang in the Gaza Strip in order to sow chaos and internal division within Palestinian society, as well as to prevent desperately needed aid from reaching the population by systematic looting backed up by Israeli military forces. Former Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman even revealed that this gang, led by a Palestinian named Yasser Abu Shabab, included some members who have been affiliated to ISIS. Israeli news site Ynet reported that, quote, the operation, led by the Shin Bet Internal Security Service, is described as planned and managed with the goal of reducing Israeli military casualties while systematically undermining Hamas through targeted strikes, infrastructure destruction, and the promotion of rival local forces. The article quotes an unnamed senior official who is likely to be a Shin Bet intelligence officer. He says, quote, it's a calculated effort. It clearly disrupts Hamas's ability to maintain the deterrence and security it once enjoyed. Eventually, it could open the door to new governing alternatives, end quote. According to Ynet, Lieberman actually violated Israel's strict military censorship laws to publicize his claims, which were then mostly confirmed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Lieberman, a former political ally turned rival to Netanyahu, apparently exposed Israel's arming of the Abu Shabab militia as a form of political point scoring, perhaps with an eye on the Israeli elections currently due by October 2026, but which could come sooner if ongoing efforts to topple Netanyahu's coalition are successful. Lieberman's criticism is that ISIS guns would eventually be turned on Israel. Joining us on the Electronic Intifada podcast to discuss the Yasser Abu Shabab gang and the wider issue of Israel's attempt to recruit Palestinian collaborators is Mohammed Shahadeh. A Palestinian analyst and writer from Gaza, Mohammed is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. His regular updates and commentary on Twitter X have earned him a huge following, especially since the beginning of the genocide. Mohammed, welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks so much, my friend Ali, for having me. Great to be with you.
Thank you, Mohammed. So, Mohammed, let's start by talking about the size and nature of this gang. You've actually written a detailed article about this issue for The New Arab. And in it, you write, branding these gangs as potential rivals to Hamas masks the very goal of why Israel created them in the first place. Around 300 untrained thieves, drug dealers, criminals, and convicted murderers cannot overpower Hamas's estimated 30,000 militants. So, in your view, what is Israel's real goal in setting up this militia, and how exactly has it supported them?
Well, I think the easiest way to start is, if you've ever watched the movie Iron Man or read the novels, is this character that's the leader of the Ten Rings terrorist organization, and he's called the Mandarin. He's this fearsome character, all-powerful and great and terrifying, until Iron Man busts his bunker and figures out that he's a failing actor called Trevor Slattery, who cannot even articulate a coherent sentence and runs into the bathroom and is like basically a coward, meek and mild. And it's the same picture that you have here. The guy that Israel claims to be the head of the most fearsome gang in Gaza is about 1.50 meter tall. He's very short, with a squint eye, very weak, no muscle mass, no character, illiterate, dropped out of school at an early age, and a long history of drug-related offenses. He was imprisoned for 25 years before October 7th, almost 10 years before today, in 2015, for possession of large quantities of narcotics, basically marijuana and other drugs as well. Basically, he escaped after October 7th, and the only lifeline that was extended to him was Israel, because they couldn't find any person in Gaza that was willing to collaborate. So Netanyahu chose what would be a perfect match for his own personal dilemma: criminals on the run from authority who know that if the genocide is over, they would end up in prison just like him. And that's what you have on your hand, basically a bunch of collaborators. I've literally looked through the names of the prominent leaders of the gang, and I got about 20 names so far. And basically, the overwhelming majority of them are either known or convicted drug dealers, murderers, collaborators, ISIS members, or thieves. So Israel is creating this mini group of criminals on the run who have a vested interest in collaborating to survive, and trying to use them as a front to advance the genocide. Israel has no intention whatsoever to use that gang to challenge Hamas. They did not engage in any battles whatsoever against the Qassam brigades. They did not engage in any combat whatsoever that we know of. The only incidents that we know of is basically Hamas ambushing some members of the gang. And every time that happens, most of the time the IDF would intervene and bomb policemen or volunteers or anyone whatsoever that would try to get near them. And they're there just basically to advance the starvation, while at the same time building a concentration camp in eastern Rafah to lure people there with the very aid that they have been looting systematically. And they're there to advance basically complete societal collapse in Gaza, try to spread terror as much as possible, organize criminal activities throughout Gaza, attacking shopkeepers, markets, whatever businesses are still there that haven't been destroyed by Israel. And they're there finally to be basically slaves for the IDF, to outsource risks to Israeli soldiers. So every time Israelis are about to enter an area, they first send the drones and then the dogs and finally the tanks and then the soldiers. The soldiers are the very last to walk on foot once they guaranteed the area is completely clear. Now the hierarchy changed. They send those gang members and then the drones, then the dogs, then the tanks, then the soldiers. And that's basically what you have at hand.
Thanks for that. That makes a lot of sense when you outline it like that. Let's talk about the groups linked to ISIS that you mentioned there. ISIS or Daesh, the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or Islamic State, or, you know, it has it's shifting nomenclature. Avigdor Lieberman, the former defense minister that Ali mentioned at the beginning, said that the Abu Shabab gang has ties to ISIS, a point Netanyahu did not deny. In your New Arab article, Mohammed, you talk about how some of Abu Shabab's deputies are associated with extremist groups, including the so-called Army of Islam, which kidnapped the BBC journalist Alan Johnson in 2007. And then the group later pledged allegiance to ISIS in 2015. Just how close is Yasser Abu Shabab's militia to ISIS, and would it be accurate to describe it as ISIS affiliated, or is it more a matter of it being composed of a ragtag of criminal elements? Does this group or the individuals in it actually have an ideology, or are they just opportunists?
It's basically a whole bunch of an open buffet of criminals, you can say. people from different backgrounds. The only thing that unites them is survival. Israel says that if you collaborate with us, you get a safe shelter, you get power, you get weaponry, money, logistical support. You get to enter Israel itself and hide there whenever there is a ceasefire. And you get to be the king of Gaza, basically. And that's the only thing that unites them. It's purely transactional. I don't think there's any ideology whatsoever. But for example, with Yasser himself and Israeli media themselves admit this, that the smuggling into Gaza, drug smuggling, was facilitated by those ISIS gangs in the Sinai Peninsula that Abu Shabab was using, according again to Israeli sources themselves, that they admit this, that he was using his links with ISIS in Sinai to smuggle drugs into Gaza. Then you have his deputy and basically the de facto leader of the gang, Ghassan Dhani, who, according again to Israeli sources, they say that his brother, Nidaot Ahranot, his brother Walid, they say that he was an ISIS member. And he was involved in many activities, prominent activities that surfaced on the Israeli radar. His other brother, according to local authorities, was a drug dealer that died in prison after being caught with large quantities of narcotics. Ghassan himself, according to local authorities, was a lieutenant in the Palestinian Authority security forces. And after leaving them, he basically joined Jaish al-Islam that you mentioned, that pledged allegiance to ISIS, and was their main guy in Rafah, according to authorities in Gaza. And he was the one in charge of smuggling through Sinai in and out of Gaza. So basically, you have the second in command after Ghassan is Asam Nabahin, whom Israelis themselves note that he was involved in firing rockets on Israel before October 7th, quote, without Hamas's authorization. And the local police in Gaza has long suspected and alleged that Israel was using elements like Assam and other ISIS affiliates in Gaza to fire rockets from time to another to create a pretext for the IDF to bomb predetermined targets in Gaza, carry out assassinations or bomb different targets, whatever they wanted, at any time of convenience. And you have basically the IDF chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, that was saying in the middle of the genocide that it's okay if we sign a deal with Hamas. It's not going to be very difficult for us to fabricate a pretext to get someone in Gaza to fire a few projectiles or firecrackers and then resume the genocide again. And that's the clearest admission that you have now, is Israel openly working with someone like Assad, Assam Nabahin, whom themselves say that was involved in firing rockets against them. His name was more prominent in Egypt than in Gaza, because he surfaced on the Egyptian radars as basically an ISIS member in Sinai that escaped Gaza after a series of attacks against Hamas. And again, it shows how ridiculous Israel's initial mantra going into the genocide was, of saying ISIS is Hamas and Hamas is ISIS. Do you remember the booklet, or the basically the terrorist manual that you found on a Hamas militant in a kibbutz in Israel, where they said,
the
okay,
flags.
Exactly. And it's a manual on how to manufacture chemical weaponry within 5 seconds. It's like chemical weapons for dummy, basically. And this entirely collapses now, where you see Israel hand in hand working with those ISIS prominent figures in Gaza. Assam is one of the most prominent, because he is a sole survivor of the ISIS group that left Gaza to Sinai. He's the only one that we know of that survived and came to Gaza again and killed a policeman before being arrested in June 2023, convicted in a military court, and then escaping during the war and immediately joining those gangs.
I mean, this is, Ali, I know you've got another question, but just one quick point that, I mean, that's kind of how ISIS operates everywhere, right? I mean, it's quite often, although it sort of, it has this image of, and people describe it as being like the extremist group, it's quite often full of just essentially criminal elements who have a kind of, you know, superficially Islamic kind of... I guess, veneer, you could say.
Yeah, precisely. I was talking, what makes this most ironic is that I was recently talking to a criminal lawyer in the UK, and she said, like, most of her clients are people that ended up in prison for reading books or whatever material that the government deemed to be close enough to ISIS ideology or Al-Qaeda ideology, and they're rotting in prisons forever. And basically, you have Israel in Gaza supplying American-made weaponry to those ISIS members without anyone even mentioning it. I don't recall a single statement from any European or Western government whatsoever on this. They're basically like, ah, okay, if it challenges Hamas, yalla, go ahead, mashallah, habibi. And that's what you have on the ground.
Well, I want to draw your attention to an article by Haaretz journalist Yossi Melman, who himself has a lot of close ties to Israeli intelligence services. He's written books, filled books with stories based on those ties. And in his own article about this Abu Shabab gang last week, he says that the project was initiated a year ago, and he emphasized that it was led by the Shin Bet, which is Israel's domestic spying, torture, and assassination agency. And he says, quote, Shin Bet instructors trained members of the Abu Shabab clan, and they were equipped with light firearms, Kalashnikov assault rifles, and handguns seized from Hamas since the start of the Gaza war, some 2,500 guns and handguns. Israel is also paying the militiamen salaries, also from money confiscated since the start of the war, an estimated $28 million, according to Melman. What do you make of Melman's claims, and how much of this represents a new strategy by Israel, and how much is just part of the same long history of attempting to recruit collaborators from within the native population of Palestine?
Oh, well, basically, the element of weaponry can be substantiated as early as around May last year, when earliest claims surfaced of this. Even in March last year, the IDF was openly saying that they wanted to arm families and clans and community leaders, or the term they used was tribal leaders, which sounds like something from colonial Congo. But basically, they tried. Nobody was willing to collaborate. So they ended up with this giant cache of weaponry, and then they found those criminals to give it to. There was a former Palestinian Authority minister that worked closely with trying to get humanitarian trucks or commercial produce into Gaza. So he was coordinating and liaising with the Israelis and acting as an intermediary. And he told me last year that basically every time the IDF would go into a neighborhood and engage with Hamas militants, if there is any battle on the ground whatsoever, they would just leave a lot of the weaponry, the light weaponry, on the bodies of the Hamas militants for the gangs to come and pick it up immediately, so the army can just wash their hands and say, it's not us, and maintain some plausible deniability. But then that moved to explicitly gathering these weapons and handing it over to the gangs in Rafah. There's the element of money as well that you mentioned. We see, most ironically, the pickup trucks that Israel has been using forever and ever as sort of the ultimate symbol of terrorism, as the ultimate symbol of ISIS. There was an advertisement by Benjamin Netanyahu in 2015 in which one of those white trucks are driving through Israel, and they ask a driver next to them, which way is Jerusalem? And he says, turn left. And it's ISIS militants that are on the back of that truck, and they're firing into the air and making zagruta and Allahu Akbar, whatever. And now you have Israel handing those very trucks, like becoming a caricature, giving those trucks to the ISIS-linked members of their gangs in Gaza and commanding them around. So that's the first element that you have there. It's basically not an autonomous entity. It is just a front for the IDF to do whatever they want and deny it. So to externalize blame, for example, they would get the gangs to loot the overwhelming majority of aid for two reasons: to maintain the starvation as a weapon of genocide and as leverage in negotiations. And number two is basically to deter and undermine, make impossible the work of UN agencies that act not only as service providers, but ultimately as witnesses on the ground of the genocide unfolding. If you look at South Africa's case at the ICJ, virtually every single footnote in there was a report by a UN agency. So Israel is trying to elbow them out by effectively unleashing those gangs to loot the overwhelming majority of aid that they try to go in. So basically, a senior official at a UN agency told me that when they try to get the truckloads through the Israeli crossing to Rim Shalom, Karm Abu Salem, the Israelis would say, good luck, come and take it, but you have to drive on this particular road only. And the road goes immediately into what is called the looting valley, where all those gangs are operating. They're basically staying in a heavily fortified compound of 12 buildings under IDF protection. And they set up a military complex, according to a UN internal memo. And they even have warehouses, highly sophisticated warehouses with forklifts and machinery and a bookkeeper and infinite piles of food that they've been looting since the start of the genocide. And basically, like, you see, Israel is using them explicitly to do the things that the IDF either was doing before but got caught and were pressured into ending, or to do things that the IDF cannot do because of political pressure. So, for example, every time that food goes into Gaza, every time Israel is pressured to reduce the starvation, not to end it, because European and Western leaders, they mostly care about the spectacle of food going in rather than ending the hunger. So every time you see food going in, the gangs immediately appear again. During the ceasefire with Hamas, when Israel was obliged to provide 600 trucks per day, or to allow them, not provide anything, they don't ever provide anything, they just allow trucks to go in through Egyptian territory into Gaza. And those gangs disappeared completely. The other element that's very important that you pointed out, Ali, is Israel's sort of apparatus of recruiting collaborators within Palestinian society. It's not just for information gathering. It is ultimately a tool of destroying a society from within. Take, for example, LGBT minorities in Palestine. You will see that culturally in Palestinian society, there's some element of suspicion and hostility. That is because historically, Israel would find them as the most vulnerable. It's the same with cancer patients. It's the same with women. It's the same with terminally ill patients, that Israel would find them as the most vulnerable members of society and would try to blackmail them in any way at all to recruit them as collaborators. So every time you come across any of those groups, you will look with paranoia, if not complete antagonism, because you would presume that if that person is vulnerable enough, Israel already managed to blackmail them and their collaborators. And for example, like I'm in Gaza itself, there would be stories about your imam at the mosque that you pray behind turning out to be a collaborator, or your school teacher turning out to be a collaborator. So you're engineering a society where nobody can trust anybody anymore, where paranoia rules. And then your only way of survival is to isolate from this communal structure that keeps you alive and helps you to survive, or to leave. It's ultimately part of Israel's goal, even before 1967, where they said that we cannot replicate another Nakba. So what can we do? Make the Palestinian lives as miserable as possible. So they would have only one option, to flee on their own. And we call it voluntary migration, what you see now. So you had Moshe Dayan saying in 67, we would tell Palestinians we have no solution. Whoever wants to stay shall live like dogs. Otherwise, they should leave. And it all falls within the same apparatus. But now the difference is Israel's ethnic cleansing was attritional. Now they want to do it in one full swoop. So now you see them unleashing the gang to concentrate people in Rafah for the final phase of the genocide, mass expulsion. Israel knows if an Israeli general or officer demands that people move to eastern Rafah, most Gazans would say, this is a trap. They want to expel us. But if you get a proxy puppet, quote-unquote, security force dressed in Palestinian uniforms with a giant Palestinian flag in front, although Israel, this is the ridiculous part, when Israel allowed the Palestinian Authority to operate at the Rafah border crossing with EU BAM recently, they basically banned them from wearing any uniforms, any insignia, any Palestinian flags, any identifiable clothing that would give any impression that those are Palestinian Authority employees. They said, they can come either in casual clothing or pajamas, nothing more. But you have this puppet security forces dressed head to toe in military gear that Israel provides, brand new M16 rifles or Kalashnikovs, or even like Serbian rifles. I've seen an instance with Ghassan Dhani carrying a brand new Serbian rifle. I'm not sure how it even got into Gaza. I've never seen any model like this in Gaza before. And you get them to call on people to come to Rafah with a Palestinian face to it. Some people might fall for it out of biological necessity, out of pure survival, because now even GHF, the Israeli quote, solution to fight.
That's the Gaza so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Precisely. So Israel is trying to make GHF itself synonymous with a death trap. That is what UNRWA's chief, Philippe Lazzarini, has been saying. GHF is, quote, a death trap, and he repeats it every day virtually. And Israel is now telling people, if you try to get food from GHF, you're going to die. The only way you can get food is to go to eastern Rafah on the borders with Egypt, with that gang group basically caging you in.
Mohammed, I know that we want to talk more about the Palestinian Authority, but I just want to follow up on one thing you mentioned, which is the fact that Hamas has at times engaged or ambushed this group, and then the Israeli army comes in and backs them up. Have you seen, or are you aware of, any systematic effort by the resistance in Gaza to deal with this phenomenon? Or is it simply because there was an operation, I think, a few weeks ago when Hamas carried out an attack on what it thought were undercover Israelis dressed as Palestinians, and then it turned out to be Palestinian collaborators. Do you know more about that incident and more generally if the resistance is systematically trying to root this phenomenon out?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're constantly gathering intelligence and surveilling the areas where those gangs are operating, and they sort of mapped out their locations. The problem is that they're very well entrenched behind multiple lines of Israeli forces basically kept as a puppet to unleash whenever they want. They tried to ambush some of them, or they try from time to another. So they ambushed them in November last year, killed Abu Shabab's younger brother, Fathi, who was basically their bookkeeper, and they killed 21 other members of the gang the day after Abu Shabab burned a fuel truck in Rafah and closed down the entire line of supply for humanitarian aid, according to the Financial Times. And basically you had mediators trying to convince him to allow aid in. He wouldn't budge until Israel, with a click of a button, forced him to move away. You see, basically, Hamas, whether you have to distinguish, there's the police, the internal security, and then the Qassam forces. Each one of them is autonomous from the other. Then there is the emergency committee, which is basically a collection of the police, civil servants, makhatir, community leaders, volunteers, civil society, etc. And each of them tries to work against those gangs in every way possible. You hear basically about Israel not trying only with that gang. They tried earlier with a family in northern Gaza that was Dogmush. It's basically the very clan from which Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, emerged, and the very clan from which Mumtaz Dogmush and others, I think, kidnapped Alan Johnston in 2007. And Israel was trying to offer them logistical support, weaponry, money, etc. They tried so hard to pressure them. Hamas managed to deter that kind of collaboration in its bud. It didn't work out. They tried with other families. They're still trying until now. So Israel is trying in northern Gaza, in Shija'iya, for example, and you have the Qassam brigades or the police dealing with it immediately. The Abu Shabab gang was recently trying with a large family in Khan Yunis. It's called the Barbakh family, and they tried to recruit members from that family as well. And then you have the police or the Qassam brigades trying to deal with it. The difference in capacity is that the Qassam brigades have access to tunnels. They have access to or they have the ability to lay ambushes for these groups. The police has more systematic access to basic government institutions or infrastructure, as well as civil society. So they operate on two different levels. But by the end of the day, yes, there's a consistent effort to undermine the Israeli ability to recruit criminals and gangs in Gaza. You can see that one element of it is that since October 7th, there hasn't been any leak from inside Hamas on the whereabouts of Israeli captives. Israel offered $5 million, a safe exit, to any Hamas member that would come forward. And there were none that we know of, not a single case. Israelis keep citing this as saying, it's a proof of guilt that there are no innocents in Gaza, to give us information about where Israeli soldiers are being held, the very soldiers whose release would be the guarantee to ending the genocide. But it basically shows ideological commitment to a cause that you cannot get a single person to snitch. People understand if those captives are gone, the genocide would continue forever. So they've become more or less, in Israel's own word, they've become the insurance policy to end this genocide.
Let's talk about the Palestinian Authority a little bit. Yasser Abu Shabab himself, in a recent video, claimed to be working under what he called was a legitimate authority. But the Palestinian Authority itself actually rejected his claim. And in your article, you write, quote, Abu Shabab's deputy is thought to be Hassan Dahini, who you mentioned earlier, 38, reportedly a former lieutenant in the Palestinian Authority. Dahini is the one running the gang's operations on the ground and actively trying to recruit new members, end of quote. And you actually pointed out his Facebook profile here, which we've got on the screen here, and you can see he has, as you point out, he has these
Israeli hostage
ribbons, which is, I found astonishing, personally. Mm. And you can see from his profile photo, he has similar sort of equipment to the Palestinian Authority, which, as it does in the West Bank, and some of the group even have these Palestinian flags on their uniforms. And in Yossi Melman's article too, in his Shin Bet sourced article, he writes that, quote, some militia members used to be Fatah supporters who opposed Hamas and were imprisoned in prisons around Gaza, In the chaos created by the war, hundreds of them managed to escape. Before and during the war, Hamas executed some members of the Abu Shabab clan for cooperating with Israel. Abu Shabab has also been in and out of Hamas prisons. You mentioned that. All this makes it more likely that the militia also has ties to the Palestinian Authority's security agencies, which continue to have close cooperation and security coordination with the IDF and Shin Bet, end of quote. So, Mohammed, what's your assessment of the PA's potential role here, and as well as its denials of ties to the Yasser Abu Shabab gang?
Well, I think Israel's magic weapon has always been the word, it's complicated. It's not a basically a sentence, it's a verb. It's complicated as an Israeli action that every time they're caught red-handed, their goal is not to make the case for Israel. Their goal is to basically tire you out, exhaust your mind until it's bleeding, so you give up on the topic and you move to the next thing in life. I have a brilliant friend, Fadi Quran, who basically infiltrated a Hillel group in the West Coast in the U.S. when he was studying at Stanford. And he attended once training at an Israeli consulate. He said the trainer came in and said, on a university campus, there would be about 10 to 20% of the students that are pro-Palestinian, 10%, 20% that are pro-Israeli. What do you do about the 60, 70% in the middle? And all the students were saying, we tried to win them over. We tried to convince them. He said, no, that's the wrong strategy. You would be wasting your time. Your goal is to tell them, nah, it's complicated. It's too much. Don't bother following on this. You only make your brain hurt. And if they don't listen to you, then tell them the second weapon is, why do you choose to focus on this topic out of everything happening? Is it because of anti-Semitism? So your goal is to basically neutralize him. And that's what Israel is trying to do now with the Abu Shabab gang. They're trying to create some confusion around what's happening here. It's basically a proxy. It's a front, not even a proxy. It's just a puppet like Travis Slattery from Iron Man. They're used by Israel to do Israel's own dirtiest actions and then pretend that they have nothing to do with it. They might have some attachments. I've heard reports, for example, that they have links to specific leaders in the Palestinian Authority intelligence apparatus. But in that apparatus, you have a lot of individuals that are compromised, that are basically collaborators with Israel. So in that regard, it is plausible that there is some level of collaboration. But on the leadership level of the Palestinian Authority, I don't think that Abu Mazen would try to get into Gaza through a drug dealer. He didn't want to try to go into Gaza through a technocratic, independent commission that Egypt was proposing, that the entire Arab world was standing behind, or Arab governments, basically, at the Egyptian summit, the Egyptian plan. He didn't want to go into Gaza through that kind of plan. He basically, his thinking until recently from people that are close to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, they tell us that he expects Hamas to collapse, and then he expects Israel and the entire world to beg him to come to Gaza and take over on his own terms. He's not in a hurry to take over. He doesn't see any compelling necessity. He basically wants to go once it is on his terms and once he gets something big out of it. So I don't expect that he would try to sneak his way in through a gang. It would have worked much better for him to tell Israel, okay, I'm willing to help you with my own security troops in Gaza itself. Like the PA has tens of thousands of civil servants in Gaza who've been deactivated since 2007. And they've been receiving salaries ever since. He can easily activate as many as he wants and use them to do whatever bidding that would be part of an agreement with Israel. But you haven't seen that either in Gaza. There was an earlier report of the Palestinian intelligence, or an official in the Palestinian intelligence, using some of those security forces individuals in Gaza at some point, and Hamas issued a statement condemning it, and they announced that they engaged and fought against them. I haven't seen other attempts other than that one. But basically, I would caution not to complicate this too much, because Israel's best interest is to try to present this group as something that is enjoying legitimacy from multiple players, or that's something that is created to fight Hamas. Because any European government, whenever they hear, even if it's the devil incarnate, if they hear, this is going to fight Hamas, they've been programmed to understand, okay, Hamas is the worst of the worst. So if this is going to fight it, that means it's the best of the best. And that's why you have the Abu Shabab's deputy in Gaza, Ghassan Dehaney, giving an interview to an Israeli newspaper in which he's basically saying, we want to be like Julani. We're trying to implement the Julani model. And he's trying to basically crave some legitimacy by pointing out the Western normalization of the Julani model in Syria.
It's really, really so Machiavellian and so lacking in any sense of principle. I mean, of course, we expect that from Israel, but Israel can't do this alone. You mentioned how Europeans and others go along with it. But I mean, let's talk more about this strategy of deliberately sowing chaos and criminality while at the same time inducing starvation and famine that is only intensifying. In November, the Washington Post reported that this criminal gang was operating under Israeli protection in Gaza, as you've described, to help them loot aid. This recent article by Suhail Kiwan, published on the Arabic language website Arab 48, which is a publication based among Palestinian citizens of Israel in the 1948 areas. And he draws parallel, or this article draws parallels between, and excuse me, this article draws parallels and lessons with this situation in Gaza and the issue of Israeli-backed criminality within the Green Line, that's to say within the Palestinian communities inside what is now Israel. And that there's long been an issue of criminality and gangs and high rates of violence among Palestinians in Israel in certain towns, not universally, but in certainly in certain areas. And it's really reached crisis points. And Kiwan writes, within the 48 areas, that means present-day Israel, there are seeds growing strongly and under the patronage of the Kahanist National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. These are gangs that have deprived our society of safety, leading to the spread of murders, which have become almost daily occurrences. The criminals commit crimes with the sense that they are protected and that this is no longer a secret. Police leaders have admitted that there is a hand above them, preventing them from doing their job in combating crime. This means that the new Middle East that Netanyahu and his government have announced does not exclude the Palestinians of 48 from the equation. In the Gaza Strip, there is the Abu Shabab gang, a nucleus of a militia under the patronage of the occupation and perhaps with the support of one or more Arab countries. So, Mohammed, do you think that Israel is now attempting to apply lessons in divide and conquer it has learned from its campaigns to crush internal resistance or even just social cohesion among Palestinians within the boundaries of present-day Israel? And it's now trying to apply the same things in the Gaza Strip. Is there a parallel? Does it represent the same type of thinking?
There was that thinking for a very long time. You see, Israel basically, Netanyahu saying that it is in our best interest to keep Gaza and the West Bank separated or to do X and Y to pin Palestinians against each other. And that's been Israel's modus operandi for decades. But now you don't even see divide and conquer. You basically see turning society, destroying and smashing society into smithereens. That if you're in Gaza at the moment, you don't trust anyone that's around you. They can be a collaborator or they can be thieves or gang members. They can show up a knife, like you literally have people walking on the street with a bag of flour and then suddenly someone showing out of nowhere with a knife and taking all of it at the power of force. And basically, I was recently at a webinar where there was a member of this American organization, humanitarian organization in Nira, and he said that in one of their conversations with COGAT, the Israeli coordinator in the occupied territories, they asked them, if somebody in Gaza tries to protect their home from a gang that is trying to swarm it and attack it, and that individual takes out a stick or a knife, would they be deemed a target by the Israeli army? And the answer from COGAT immediately and very unambiguously said yes. An Israeli surveillance drone would pick it up immediately and identify that individual as a target, which means like Israel now has at least five layers of aerial surveillance over Gaza that we know of. They have satellite imagery nonstop of every square inch of Gaza. And they have then the giant drones, the Predator drones that are equipped with rockets to shoot to kill. And then they have a third layer of quadcopters that are, some of them are autonomous. And these three layers are equipped or linked to databases with artificial intelligence to process the huge amount of data. And the quadcopters are equipped with also weaponry to shoot to kill or loudspeakers, etc. Tear gas. We've seen Gaza being turned into basically one big showroom for Israeli startups. And then the fourth line is American surveillance missions. And the fifth is British surveillance missions that we know of recently, that they flew hundreds of hours over Gaza. So they would see every single thing that's happening on the ground. And they did not act a single time against any individual with a knife that is a member of a gang. They didn't even confuse them with a Hamas member a single time, not even once. Not even, like, they don't even show only knives. They show weaponry, pistols and guns and machine guns. At some point, there were kids literally in Deir el-Balah that were walking around in the middle of the street from a clan, and they were firing rifles into the air. And Israeli troops were only 800 meters away and did absolutely nothing about them. You see Israel basically killing kids that are carrying a water container because the IDF would say, it looked remotely suspicious. That yellow water container that says water on it, it looked like it could have been an explosive device. So we had to bomb them. And yet they do nothing about every single member of those gangs on the ground throughout the entire Gaza Strip, which means they have a vested interest in this. So Israel, from the very beginning of the genocide, one of their main stated goals is the destruction of the civil government. And they tried to keep saying the Hamas government, the Hamas government. It's not a Hamas government. It is a civil government. And we know that it's not a Hamas government because Israel itself, when they allowed the Qatari aid to go to Palestinian civil servants in that government, Netanyahu demanded a database of every single employee that would receive Qatari cash, the civil servants, the policemen, the firefighters, the doctors, the teachers, and the Shin Bet, the Mossad, different Israeli agencies. They basically ran through these databases and blacklisted only 300 names out of 35,000 employees of the government, only 300 names. They demanded fingerprints of every single employee every time they receive a salary from that Qatari aid to be submitted in a database that goes then to Israel, to Tel Aviv. And basically, they themselves cleared the overwhelming majority of employees there. But nonetheless, Israel declared the goal of destroying that government without providing any alternative. Like, Western diplomats are always frustrated and saying, Netanyahu's not providing us with a day after plan because he doesn't want to be a day after. He doesn't want to be like any sort of sunrise on Gaza once the genocide is over. He wants it an empty wasteland. That's why he's trying to, from day one, to turn Gaza into this combination of Minority Report, Mad Max, Black Mirror, Fallout, and the Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. And his pretext is, those are Hamas government employees, we have to destroy them.
It's a very, you know, it's already a situation that's beyond description. It's a genocide, it's a Holocaust, but just the levels of bleakness and horror that you've laid out for us, it's very hard to feel anything other than despair, frankly, listening to what you've laid out. But at the same time, there is a resilience among the community in Gaza. I know that that can be an overused word, but we communicate and talk with people in Gaza every day. And there is a certain, you know, the society has not collapsed completely. I mean, in a sense, I'm surprised the extent to which the society is remaining cohesive, even though people do tell us about the lack of security, the types of the lack of personal security that you talked about, the gouging by merchants, the gangs, all this kind of thing. But you're from Gaza. I don't know how long you've been away from Gaza, but talk about that society and what you think, what elements you think that will counter some of these really diabolical schemes that Israel is trying to impose and that will help it to rebuild the day after this genocide. And there will be a day after, and hopefully very soon. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent question. So there's two levels to answer it. Number one is that all of Israel's efforts to collapse society in Gaza have failed. That's why they turned to the gangs. They tried targeted assassinations. They tried carpet bombing. They destroyed every government facility in Gaza, basically. They went after the police, after doctors, teachers, whatever elements of society that would make it habitable or sustain basic organized human life. and they couldn't collapse it. It made them go nuts that when they tried to collapse the civil government in Gaza, then the emergency committee emerged that incorporated the civil government with civil society, volunteers, community leaders, different large families, etc. So that's why they turned to the gangs to try to destroy society from within Gaza itself. There's the other element is that Gaza is one of the few areas in the world where society sort of escaped new capitalism or new liberalism, that basically you see in Europe or in the US that there's be this concerted effort that there should be no more society, only individuals, because individuals cannot act as a unified mass. Whereas in Gaza, there's always this captivating essence of it, is that you have this solid social capital, you have this solid communal network that you can rely so heavily on in every aspect of your life. So we see Israel destroying virtually every single school in Gaza. And yet my friends and family members in Gaza, their kids are still studying until now. They try to study online. They try to create this these kind of community activities where volunteers would come in and teach them. They try to even like use cars or vehicles to turn it into a mobile school to move around, to maintain societal resilience. And that's one of the elements that you see basically Israel envying Palestinians for is steadfastness. Israel has been trying to do this for 75 years. They couldn't destroy even longer. They've been trying to do it from time immemorial. They couldn't destroy Palestinians. And you see this as soon as Iran started firing rockets on Israel, you had the Israeli government coming out and saying, no Israeli is allowed to leave once the airport are operational again. We're going to lock them in and use them as human shields. And now you get reports that Netanyahu doesn't even want Americans to leave Israel. He reportedly engaged in a shouting match with Mike Huckabee, about evacuating Americans out of Israel, because basically, like, you see
700,000 apparently.
A lot of them dual nationals, of course. But Israel has the interest to inflame that number immediately so that they can say this is a war against the United States as well, and then get the U.S. bogged down into this war as well.
Well, I think that that's a good place to leave it. It's a somewhat positive note in what has been really a very interesting but also sobering conversation. And we're very grateful for your meticulous research, Mohammed. People can, of course, follow you on Twitter X. And what's your Twitter handle, just so people know that?
It's Mohammed Shahada 2, but without the A at the end. It's a weird handle.
All right. Well, people will find you, and they'll definitely know you from your really good and thoughtful research on many of these issues. And just to remind everyone that Mohammed Shahada is a Palestinian analyst and writer from Gaza and is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. And as I said, you can find his really thoughtful and interesting analysis on his Twitter feed. And you write for publications. We mentioned you wrote for The New Arab, but there are other publications you write for too.
Well, I once wrote for the Electronic Intifada, and I must admit it was basically the most meticulous fact-checking process I've ever been through. It took a very, very long time. They had to go through every comma, every word to make sure it's impeccable.
Everybody says that, and we'll take it as a compliment.
But by the way, we do that for each other too.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. That's true. But that is so that we can do our best to make sure that we're sharing really thoughtful and accurate information with people. And that's what also impresses us about your work, is that there's a depth of knowledge and detail that is really impressive. And perhaps you'll write for us again and we'll put you through that fact. I promise you, we'll put you through that fact checking process again. But we would be happy for you to do that. And we'd also love to have you back on the Electronic Intifada podcast or live stream at some point. But in the meantime, thank you so much, Mohammed. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Ali Abonnet.
Birchmere presents Pieces of a Dream, June 27th. Joshua Redman, June 29th. Omar, July 17th. And Hubert Laws, July 20th. Details at birchmere.com.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabe inviting you to check out my new showgram, Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, every Thursday morning from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We present a mashup of positive, uplifting music of different genres, mainly roots reggae. We also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and so much more.